Hi, Carmen Wong Ulrich here, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of January 17th, 2014. So you know this show is about how to not only get more money out of the choices that you make in life, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, retirement rules. Hey, how about if we write our own? And the crystal ball comes out on interest rates and your wallet in 2014. But first up, millions of Americans, maybe even you, have had your credit card and debit card information stolen by hackers through big retailers like Target and Neiman Marcus. Bob Sullivan joins us to talk about what you can do to keep your money safe and what those retailers are doing to help. He's a consumer advocate and investigative journalist at bobsullivan.net. Welcome.
Sure. Hi, Carmen. How you doing?
Good, except for all of this information. I had to go scramble to make sure that I was at Target before the 27th, which I was just a day before, but I still looked at that. But here's the thing. There's some news from Target. They're trying to address this firsthand and communicate with their customers. Tell us what they're doing and what we need to look out for.
Well, for starters, Target has expanded several times the universe of people who might be victims of this. So just because you didn't shop at Target during that 18-day window, you might also be a victim of a breach that's related to the one that they've already announced. So, Carmen, I hate to break the news to you, but you and perhaps 70 million other Americans, even if they didn't take your credit card, they may have stolen your name or your email address or your mailing address from Target. So an awful lot of Americans, roughly 1 in 4, 1 in 5 U.S. adults are in this pool of victims just at Target. And as we know now, it involves more companies than Target. So we don't know where this is going to end, but I'm sure by the time we're done, this is going to be the most important credit card hack ever.
I mean, absolutely. It's got to be. It really cut into their sales results, too. They saw a big drop, like 6 to 9% of consumers buying. But what have they done? They've actually reached out to folks, because at first they were really mum about this. They didn't have any comment or to the folks who shop there. But now they're actually emailing everybody and they're trying to help. But it has a really big caveat.
It does. And to Target's credit, they are offering free credit monitoring really to anyone who goes to their website and signs up for it. And that's a deal that's worth taking. And initially, when we heard about this hack, we thought it was just credit cards and credit monitoring wouldn't help. But now that we know it involves people's addresses and other personal information, absolutely identity theft is a concern. So credit monitoring is important.
Now, you made a really good distinction here, Bob, between identity theft, your address, your email, etc., versus just having your card data stolen. In all the best worlds, we would all rather, and tell me if you agree, have just the data on a card stolen than have all your personal information as well, because that's more dangerous.
Yeah, it's quite a bit more dangerous, and it's a much bigger hassle to recover from. If it's a credit card and someone charges something fraudulently using your credit card, it's a simple phone call and you're done. But once they have your address and your email address, they don't have everything that they need. They're not all the way across the goal line to committing identity theft. We don't know yet that something like, say, a Social Security number was lost in this hack. But again, we also don't know the extent of it now. It seems to keep growing. But at any rate, full-blown identity theft is a much, much bigger problem. And it also, it's the kind of thing that could be a hassle for years to come. Just because you look at your credit report today and it seems fine, that doesn't mean anything. The criminals often will hold on to this data for a long, long time. And let me just give you one example of something I'm really worried about. Since we now know the criminals have people's email addresses and they know you shopped at Target and they know you're probably looking at your email for an email from Target, it can be very easy to send those convincing phishing emails that look like they're from Target or look like they're from a bank and say, consumer, you were a victim of this breach. Click here quickly to verify your information or to sign up for this. It's going to be very confusing for consumers. This might be the best opportunity I've ever heard of for criminals who want to send those phishing emails and dupe people into logging into web pages that they shouldn't.
Oh, my goodness. As if we don't have enough to worry about. But here's the thing. So we can assume that this is a really big wake-up call for retailers. They're really going to have to do something about their security and how the security works. But what can we do? You know, folks who hear this, for example, you and I, we know exactly kind of the steps to do. But for folks out there, whether it's a debit card or a credit card, what is the tried and true way of, okay, step one, here's what you need to do. And step two,
identity theft. It's in credit card fraud. It's really not about prevention. It's about controlling the disaster. There's very little that you can do right now. In fact, there's nothing you can do right now to stop yourself from being a victim of this leak, whether you shopped at Target or not. That's in the past. It's limiting the damage, containing the damage. So you've got to look at your credit card bills. instead of every month, do it every week. And the websites make that very, very easy to do. You can do it in 25 seconds. Just glance at all your charges. And it's January, which is probably your biggest bill of the year. And I know everybody says they look at their bills and about 3/4 of the people are lying because it takes some time and there's 25, 35, 45 things, all those Christmas gifts. But the way that the criminals do this and get away with it is they sneak in these $9 charges that look like, well, maybe it's legit, maybe it's not. You've got to look at those bills, look at those itemized bills carefully, because if you don't notice it, you're going to pay for it, and that's how they get away with it.
Oh, I had someone charging at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning $2 at a time, or 30 cents for gaming. And thankfully, my credit card company actually called me and emailed me, but I would have seen it as well, because like you mentioned, I mean, I go in there every week to scan through and make sure everything's in order. And don't forget, folks, you can always go get your free credit reports once a year at annualcreditreport.com. Now, Bob, what about one quick reaction in terms of what do some people do that you don't recommend they should do? Is there like an overreaction?
Yeah, the one thing that I still don't think people should do is call up their bank and insist on canceling their credit card right now. Banks are making their own decisions. I've heard from a couple of banks now that are just canceling their entire card base of any consumer that shopped at Target. That's because they know something that you don't. They've got these big algorithms. But again, as long as you watch your bills, you will not be a victim. You will not be out money. Just don't overreact. Just watch the mail from your bank carefully. Watch your bill carefully and take that step only when necessary.
Absolutely. Bob Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. And good luck to all those folks out there with credit cards.
So what does buying a car have to do with buying a home?
Carmen.
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 Carmen, what's going on?
What's going on is I'm taking your calls, and Glenda joins us from Los Angeles. She and her husband have a question about buying a car and a big follow-up to that. Welcome, Glenda.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So you've got a question, not necessarily about the car, but how to pay for it.
My husband and I have a good amount of savings, and we haven't bought a new used car for several years, and we're really due for a car. And we have enough savings to pay cash for the car we want, but we also, in the longer term, want to buy a house. And so we're planning ahead and trying to think of how to use this medium purchase of a car to sort of help us on our way to buy a house. My husband doesn't have the longest credit history, but we both have really good credit scores. So we're wondering if we should use a car loan to sort of, I don't know, in a strategic way, even though we can pay cash.
Well, Glenda, I like the way you're thinking strategically, because it's really smart to do that. But I'm going to ask you first. So let's go to that cash question. When you say that you have a lot of cash savings, mm-hmm. What do you have? Do you guys have at least 6 months of living expenses put away separately from the cash that you have for the car?
Yes.
So Let's do this to make you guys as gorgeous and pageant ready as possible in terms of going to get the mortgage eventually. That actually, yes, having a loan for the car, even though it's going to cost you something in interest, will help. It's a matter of a couple things. How much is the loan going to cost you? And Is that cost worthwhile to you guys? Because the car is not the only way that you guys can build your credit. You can also go and get low-limit credit cards. So you don't necessarily have to have a card that has, you know, a $5,000, $10,000 limit. You just have to use them and pay them on time, and that builds up and helps. But it is smart to think about, when you're making a big purchase, how it's going to affect future financial plans in your life. So The best way to shop for a car strategically is to keep separate shopping for the car and shopping for financing. First, shop for the car. So you want to head online. This is your little to-do list here, Glenda, is to head online, go to a site like Edmunds.com, and go and search for the make and model that you want, looking at the budget, and you can pit dealers around you against each other online through email. Once you settle on a price and a dealer, then you can shop for financing. But Since you have the cash, it actually can cost a lot. Why do that if you guys can get the credit cards and maybe build your credit better that way? So I would steer you toward building your credit in a different way.
So we have credit cards. I mean, I have a credit card that I've had for 15 years. And it's the only one I have. And my husband I think because he didn't get a credit card until he got a job. So he was like 20, in his 20s. So he's had the harder time getting a credit card. And so we each have one now. Are you suggesting that we both get two?
It's really up to you and what you guys want to do. And you could definitely get another card. Your husband should try to get another card. And just be very diligent about managing those cards. Don't forget, a big part of your credit history is that word history. So right. Your husband waiting longer, basically he's being a little bit treated like a 20-year-old. You know, because it's kind of like the credit clock only starts when you start borrowing. And you could be 40 and start using credit, and you could have the credit score of a 20-year-old. So that's what you want
to
do.
You're saying that I'm married to a credit teenager right now?
Aww. You turn the tables. You cougar, you.
Yeah, when I'm 45, I'll be able to honestly say that I'm more in my 20s. That's great.
Yes, exactly. But that's the thing, that you guys can get closer to meeting in the middle simply by taking on a little bit more in terms of opening lines of credit. You don't have to carry balances. The car loan can help you as well, but make sure that you talk down that price of that car as much as possible, because there's like a 20% big gap in terms of negotiating it down.
Yeah, that's nothing to joke about.
Absolutely not. That's more cash in your pocket. And the extra cash goes towards the home. So you'll have the cash to buy the home, and you'll have the credit to buy the home, and you'll have the car.
Most important in LA.
Exactly. I've been stuck in that traffic, so I sympathize. Glenda, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And next week, it's all about your credit. Do you have a credit question? Go to marketplacemoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. Just ahead, few of us get a full ride, so you might as well get comfy with Plan B.
As much as we'd like to avoid borrowing student loans, we can borrow if we need to help access education, and we can't borrow to finance our own retirement, for example.
The best student loan options coming up next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. We get a lot of questions about student loans and paying for college, and it is now the largest outstanding debt that Americans have, over $1 trillion in student loans. So joining us today to talk about these things and answer some questions is Heather Jarvis. She's an attorney specializing in student loan education and the founder of AskHeatherJarvis.com. Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Heather, we're going to talk to some folks who have loans who need some help paying these loans. We've got Brandon joining us from San Antonio, Texas. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carmen. Thank you for having me.
So you're 27. You're looking to go back to grad school. You're in a good field, mechanical engineering, but you still have some undergrad debt. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I have about $20,000 in undergraduate debt, interest rates between 1.5% and 5%.
Wow.
And I guess I'm trying to figure out, I've got another 8 months of working, but my question is it better for me to pay off that debt now or save up my pennies for actual graduate school to have for living expenses and such?
The price tag for graduate school, sometimes it's huge or even bigger than undergrad. What is that going to look like for you?
Well, I'm hopefully going to get in-state tuition, and hopefully I think the cost will be between $30,000 and $40,000 total between living expenses and tuition.
And will that be loans, or will you have that money, or is that your question?
I'm going to look for help in any way I can to help pay for it. But I'm assuming worst case scenario, if I have to take everything out in loans, what should I be doing? What other programs should I be looking for?
Well, Heather, this is fairly common, right? I mean, this happened to me, having undergrad loans and then going to graduate school and taking out more loans. So how should Brandon approach this?
Well, let me ask you a couple of other questions, Brandon, to make sure I know what your circumstances are. Did you borrow entirely federal student loans, or do you have any private student loans?
Entirely federal.
And is all of that debt in subsidized federal loans, as far as you're aware?
About three quarters of it is in all subsidized.
The best loans to have, because low interest, definitely.
What you'll find, Brandon, is that you won't have access to debt that is quite that affordable when you return to graduate school, because subsidized loans are no longer available for graduate and professional students. That was only changed in 2012. But you will have to borrow only unsubsidized loans. And for your listeners who aren't aware, the subsidy is quite valuable. It just means that the government pays the interest that accrues while the student is in school and during certain other periods of deferment on the loans when payment is postponed. And so if Brandon hasn't fully repaid his debt when he goes to graduate school, he won't be subject to the interest accrual on the subsidized portion of his debt, whereas the new loans he's taking out will not have a subsidy ever. You will be paying, we don't know exactly how much, but for example, if you were in school right now, your interest rate would be 5.41% on your unsubsidized federal loans for graduate school. And you'd be limited to how much you could borrow at that rate. And then some of your debt would be at a higher rate. Right now, it'd be 6.4. And next year, it'll probably be somewhat higher. Consider the fact that the debt you have now is cheaper than the debt you'll have access to when you get to grad school. So you might want to save some, with the understanding that the unsubsidized portion of your debt is in fact costing you money right now and will continue to do that every minute of every day until it's fully repaid.
No pressure, Brandon. No pressure. It's a really good point to make. Not all student loans are built the same. I see these loans and these interest rates, Brandon, that you have at undergrad, and wow, those are fantastically cheap. And I have to assume you're in engineering. I would assume you get a pay jump with a grad degree. Is that going to be substantial?
Yes, it's going to be very substantial.
Ooh, that's so great, Brandon. Engineering, that's the way to go. But Heather, how should he manage taking on these new, more pricey loans, especially in school and then when he graduates?
Well, what I would recommend for Brandon and really everyone is that we should all fill out the free application for federal student aid, whether you believe you qualify or not, and whether it's undergraduate school or graduate school, because that's the foundation of all financial aid, including institutional aid or scholarships that a school might be able to provide, as well as all the different loan programs. So if you qualify, and this depends on financial need, you might want to take a look at whether the school you're interested in offers a Perkins loan, which is the lowest interest federal student loan program that you may be able to access. That will be at a fixed rate of 5%. But there's not a whole lot of money in the Perkins program right now, so you're more likely to be looking at these unsubsidized loans. But what I would recommend that you do really above all else is avoid private student loans. Because interest rates in the market are so low, private student loans might look like a good option. And they can be appropriate for people in certain circumstances, but they are, in general, more expensive and risky than federal student loans. They tend to have higher interest rates that are variable and can sometimes go up with no cap. So I would really advise you, Brandon, to just be sure you avoid the private student loans. Focus instead on first Perkins if you can qualify, then the unsubsidized Stafford loans, and you'll want to pay those that are more expensive for you and that do not have a subsidy more aggressively.
Brandon, what do you think?
That's great. I honestly didn't even really think to treat them differently. I actually didn't even realize I wouldn't be able to access some of these other loans. I guess I've taken the good fortune for granted.
But the real good news here is, Brandon, is that you have really inexpensive undergrad loans, don't need to be in a rush there, and that your income and job prospects, especially in the field that you're in, are going to be nice and juicy and be there for you to take care of those loans. Brandon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Heather, stick around with us. We are going to come back after the break with someone getting close to retirement who's currently juggling student loans. This is Marketplace Money from APM. Carmen Wong Ulrich here, and I'm talking with Heather Jarvis. She's an attorney who specializes in student loan education, and we're taking some calls. We're going to head over to Catherine in Ridgefield in Washington State. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. You are in a really interesting, though I think surely more common situation, where you are getting closer to retirement age. You're 55, and you have student loans.
I do, and it's something I'd rather not have, obviously, but I'm trying to figure out a way to see what is the best option for me to get out of this loan situation by using the student loan forgiveness program.
You're working with the Department of Corrections.
Yes.
And your loans are federal, correct?
Correct. They're federal subsidized loans.
And how much are we talking here?
Oh, it's horrible. it's still at $58,365.17 as of yesterday.
So, Heather, in terms of student loan forgiveness, let's talk about how does that work, and is Kathy a viable candidate?
Yeah, Kathy, you're asking the right questions. And what we need to do to figure out how you can benefit is first to look into even more closely what kind of subsidized federal loans you have. Years ago, there were two sources of federal student loans. There was an old program where banks and private lenders originated the loans on behalf of the federal government. And that was done away with in 2010. But I'm guessing you have some of your loans from before then. So we'd need to make sure that if you don't have what are called federal direct loans, you may need to take the step of consolidating those federal student loans into another loan, essentially refinancing them.
Okay.
So because the Federal Direct Loan Program has a program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness, which is also rather new and can be very beneficial to people who are working in government and nonprofit positions. The Department of Corrections would certainly qualify as a public service employer. Really, the rub with public service loan forgiveness is that the devil's in the details. The program is convoluted and complex, and it's vital that you get all the details right. But essentially, the way it works is that a student loan borrower who's working in a position like the one that you're in will make payments on their student loans under a particular repayment plan. You have to select an eligible repayment plan. And for you, that would be something called income-based repayment.
Yeah, Kathy, do you have that plan now? Because you reduced your monthly payments, were able to reduce them quite a bit.
Well, I do. I've worked out something that's going to take till, you know, the cows come home. I'll probably be dead and still owe on my student loans.
We're going to take care of that, Kathy.
Well, my payment is $204.50 a month, but 2 years of furlough time until it just ended this July. It was really tight, and so I did do some forbearance time as well, so that basically just built my loan while I wasn't paying, because I wasn't paying on the interest accruing either at the time. So,
well, and Kathy, you have had these loans since 1999, is that correct?
Well, yeah, because I graduated in 1999, and they started in 1997, and so yeah, I've been paying on them since then, and it's just like it will never go away.
Heather, if she is in the public sector, why are these loans still alive? Because if they are federal, there is a limitation as to how many years that you'll be paying the federal loan, correct? And then she could also have forgiveness, or no?
That's right, Carmen. But the requirements to qualify for forgiveness are so specific that they, first of all, didn't take effect until at the earliest 2007 was when the legislation passed that created public service loan forgiveness and the income-based repayment plan. So no one can get credit for the time they served in government, for example.
until no credit
2007.
For time served.
Right. So I'm sure Kathy understands that with the Department of Corrections. And many of us have to take specific actions like consolidate and change repayment plans before we can, in fact, start getting any closer to forgiveness. And then it takes 10 years from that time before public service forgiveness is earned. And in terms of an absolute cap on how long you repay federal loans, that is 25 years under the income-based repayment plan. So it's a good option for people who need a reduced payment. But I want, Kathy, I want you to be aware that there are a lot of repayment plans that people can choose from. And you might be on a long-term repayment plan, like a 20-year plan or 25-year plan. And that may well not be what's best for you.
Okay. Mm.
You want to double check and see whether your plan is based on your income specifically, because those are the only repayment options that will qualify you for forgiveness.
Practically, for Kathy, the steps that she can take, so she can go to...
Yeah, so what Kathy and all of us with loans should do first is visit the National Student Loan Data System. It's online at nslds.ed.gov. And that's the federal database of federal loans. We should look there rather than at our regular user interface with our loan servicer like the Sallie Mae site, and look at all your federal loans there. She'll want to check whether they are federal direct loans, which means mm-hmm. that the lender is the U.S. Department of Education.
Right.
And then following that, she can look for some more resources on the Department of Education website for how to do things like consolidate if that's necessary and change repayment plans. So you can and do have to essentially do it yourself in terms of the research, and just look for those .gov websites as opposed to anything else.
Kathy, absolutely reach out to us. Let us know if you get some of this debt forgiven. Man, would we love to hear from you.
Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it. Nice talking with you, ladies. Thank you.
And Heather, thank you so much for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carmen.
You can find more of Heather Jarvis's student loan advice at marketplacemoney.org. So a story we covered at Marketplace last year had a big update this week. Apple has agreed to settle with the FTC for millions of dollars over complaints from parents that the Apple App Store allowed kids to make purchases for several minutes after a parent would log in to allow one purchase. Now, some parents were hit with bills in the thousands of dollars. Here to discuss the suit and what we grown-ups can do to thwart our app-happy kids is Monica Vila. She's a blogger at the parenting site Babbel.com and editor-in-chief of the OnlineMom.com. Monica, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
So, Monica, explain a little bit about this lawsuit, why it happened, and why they're settling.
Yeah, with the popularity of games and mobile games in particular, many parents were caught off guard with the in-app purchases their kids were making. And particularly troublesome was the fact that they were unaware that once a game is downloaded, there was a window of opportunity for additional expenditures to be made without express consent. And so this complaint actually makes Apple pay back those consumers, those parents that were caught off guard.
Well, that's amazing, because if my 7-year-old daughter knew that there was a 15-minute window, I would be absolutely broke right now. I would be absolutely broke. So they're going to get refunds from this suit, correct? How is that going to work? Because a lot of parents, I'm sure, don't even know that they can have a refund on this.
Right. So the recourse for parents is Apple will be notifying everyone that the process is in place and will provide links so that a parent has to actually make the request for them to be paid.
Okay, good.
And Apple is forced to actually do that, is in that position, and will be making it hopefully as easy as possible for those claims to be made.
Now, two key takeaways here, because I know with my daughter at her age, she asks me, she says she gets a free game. She says, Mom, it's free. But then she comes to me 10 minutes later and says, to keep this thing alive, I need 100 coins for only $1.99. So there are teachable moments here in terms of, okay, what can we do to get them to understand? Because it doesn't seem or feel like real money. And also what we can do to stop them from spending too much.
Yeah, I mean, this actually is one of those great issues for parents. We're constantly pressured by the onslaught of digital opportunities that our kids have. And so use this opportunity to explain the difference between both worlds and how the same rules would apply. So, for example, you can actually give your child an iTunes allowance account, which actually gives a child the opportunity to make prudent decisions. But it doesn't separate the fact that parents need to be really involved in what their kids are doing. Many times when your daughter comes to you and says, you know, I need more money to save my pony.
Coins or whatever.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to actually discuss the difference between the real world and the virtual world.
Well, I had to get her. She started getting allowance at 7. So I told her she's going to have to pay for these things out of her allowance. I make her physically go to her room and give me dollar bills. But I think that with app developers, it seems like they're trying to find ways to separate the cost, the real cost, from what's actually happening. Can we expect that that's just going to happen more and more?
I actually think that the tendency is for it to happen less now that the FTC has stepped in. I mean, we have a trust relationship with companies like Apple, who have a very close gateway for apps to be distributed through their system. And so I think this is one of those things that will actually tend to be more obvious for us. I mean, you have to understand also this is huge business. Apple's total revenue for in-app purchases was $10 billion last year.
$10
billion. 76% of which is accounted for by in-app purchases. But parents need to be aware that there are games in other platforms, in the Android platform, as well as the Windows phone platform. And so just be very involved and always discuss that money spent virtually is the same as money spent in the real world.
It absolutely is. You always get the bill. Thank you so much, Monica, for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
Monica Vila is a blogger at Babbel.com and editor-in-chief of theonlinemom.com. Coming up, retirement rules of thumb. Who needs them? Let's write our own.
The 4% rule came about over 20 years ago based upon the idea that when you retire, you take out 4% from your 401k, for example, and you increase that amount every year by inflation.
Retirement math, next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong-Ulrich. So after you've hopefully enjoyed the fruits of your education labor and your subsequent career, you hope for a nice nest egg for retirement. But once you're there in retirement, how do you make sure that your savings last, all while enjoying the things that you couldn't do while you were working? Here to shed some light on if the old rules of retirement still make sense today is David Blanchett. He's the head of investment research at Morningstar Investment Management. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We've heard some of those and some of the rules of thumb. For example, you need to save a certain multiple of your annual income, and then you need to withdraw 4%. Where did these numbers come from, and do they even still apply?
So I would say that some of these general rules are decent starting places for a lot of individuals. The problem is that everyone's so different, and it's nice to apply a simple rule of thumb to everyone, but the problem is it can be way off. And so you mentioned the 4% rule. The 4% rule came about around over 20 years ago based upon the idea that when you retire, you take out 4% from your 401k, for example, then you increase that amount every year by inflation. The problem is the 4% rule is kind of based on a couple, both age 65. It doesn't really apply to someone who's single and age 65, a married couple who's 75. And so it's a good starting point, but it's not very realistic for every type of retiree.
Where does income fall in all of this? Because the folks are still estimating their retirement needs based solely on what money they're bringing in.
That's right. And I really think that things like the 4% rule provide a better insight as to how much you have to have saved for retirement. So 1 divided by 4% is 25. So whatever income need you have to create that's not covered by things like a pension or Social Security, you need about 20 or 25 times that income amount when you actually retire. Now, the actual income component, though, is far more complex. I'm not convinced that individuals, for example, who are who are 65 years old will spend the same as someone who is, say, 85 years old, because you have different types of expenses over your lifetime. And someone who's 65, for example, might want to go on a cruise that isn't really possible for someone who's 85.
And then in terms of spending and where that spending is going to come from that you're not used to, for example, healthcare costs. Talk a little bit about how healthcare costs and those growing as you get older can affect your retirement planning.
Right now, if you look at U.S. data, about 10% of expenses for retirees who are 65 years old go to healthcare costs. That number rises to about 20% on average for those that are 85. But the problem is that's data based upon today.
What about the expenses that are going to be cut? Because a lot of folks, maybe they assume or they hope that they won't be paying a mortgage anymore. But there's also the taxes. The tax situation changes, right?
Correct. It's a really complex calculation to figure out how much you need. And I think that the best approach is to say, hey, you know, what am I living off of today? And what will I need to live off of in retirement? Because a lot of individuals may have students that are in college, their children they're paying for. They may have a mortgage they're paying for. And so kind of look at your holistic balance sheet and say, hey, you know, right now I need $40,000 a year after taxes to live. And that should be your target for your kind of effective replacement rate when you retire.
How does market performance or should market performance affect how much you're with saving and withdrawing from retirement?
So it's really interesting if you look at market performance, because a lot of people tend to retire after markets have done well. And unfortunately, after markets do well, they tend to do poorly. And while 2013 was a very good year for stocks, up about 30%, bonds are still doing quite poorly. The yield on bonds is around 2 or 3%, and that's about 3% below long-term averages. And if you look at retirees or older individuals, they tend to invest very conservatively. And so while the markets are doing well, the unfortunate part of it is that most retirees aren't experiencing that. And so I think that in reality today you have to save more and more and more, because the outlook for future performance for the stock and bond markets isn't very good over the next maybe 5, 10, or 20 years.
I talk to a lot of CFPs who say, yeah, you know, when the market's doing really great, maybe you withdraw less or maybe you withdraw more. And then when the market's doing very badly, you're going to have to cut down. So instead of withdrawing 4%, you withdraw 3%. Is that kind of flexibility something to look at?
If you absolutely cannot afford to have your expenses cut, then just spend the same amount every year. Okay, don't change that. But I think for most people that are okay with making changes, you should kind of adapt to situations change, because there's two key unknown variables you have to think about when determining how much to pull from a portfolio. The first is how long you're going to live, and the second is the returns you're going to experience. And obviously then if your portfolio does better than expected, you should live off more and kind of enjoy that money. Because one problem that I have with a lot of research on retirement income is that there's actually two really bad things that can happen. Okay. The first bad thing is that you have no money when you're 90 years old. Okay. The other bad thing, though, is having this huge pot of wealth when you're 90. Because if you have all this money that you didn't spend, you didn't live your life to the fullest. The best solution, the best plan for a retiree is to kind of balance that consumption over their lifetime so that they ensure that they're kind of maximizing their lifetime income.
Great. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Blanchett is head of retirement research for Morningstar Investment Management. If you have a retirement question or want to look for your magic number and have questions, make sure to go to marketplacemoney.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. So how you were raised when it comes to money influences your point of view now. Today, a musician talks about the differences between his mom and his dad and how he learned from both.
I'm John Roderick. I play in a band called The Long Winters. I used to be in the band Harvey Danger that had the big hit Flagpole Sitta in the late 90s. And The Long Winters have been my band since the early 2000s. You know, the lessons that I learned from my parents are that money can make you very unhappy, no matter what your philosophy of it is. And having a healthy relationship to money is extremely important. When I first started making music, the idea was still based on a kind of hit the lottery idea of how a band became successful. I had a day job where I worked at a magazine shop because then I was going to be a rock star and I was going to hit it rich and then I would have a white swimming pool and a waterfall. That did not happen. I did not get a white swimming pool. My mom was a computer programmer and my dad was a lawyer. Their relationship to money was very different. My father was a spendthrift and a playboy. If he got $5,000, he would spend $6,000. My mom was frugal and somebody to whom money meant more than just what it could buy. Saving money was a way of feeling secure. So I was taught both approaches, and that schizophrenic relationship to money and saving was a real challenge to me as I developed my business. At a certain point in the mid-2000s, the band started making money. That was when I had to really scramble. I was running a small business, and I had 6 to 10 employees, and I had to learn how to pay taxes. I had to learn how to run a business. Fight. You know, my instinct was to sit and bicker over who didn't put a dollar in on the tip. But part of being a band leader is that you need to spend money sometimes. If you've got your 5 bandmates there and you're buying a fancy dinner, you know, you don't want to be standing at the table collecting $22 from everybody at the table. Like, that just isn't hot. You need to be able to spend $500 on dinner sometimes. And for me to be anxious about the money is just to do myself the disservice of not enjoying the moment I'm in. You know, I had to learn to adopt my dad's carefreeness about, well, the money's going to show up. Let's just assume it does. But also really maintain my mother's vigilance over the big picture. You have to recognize that money cannot heal you. It can't heal you by spending it, and it can't heal you by saving it. And adopting that has absolutely improved the quality of my life and I think made me a better artist.
Striking a balance as a rock and roll CEO. Send us your lessons about growing up and money. You can tweet us at LiveMoney or record your story at MarketplaceMoney.org. So I'm not usually a fan of crystal balls, but sometimes knowing what might happen down the road can really help us with our own financial planning. Kiplinger recently released its economic forecast for 2014, and some of its projections will hit our wallets this year in both good and bad ways. Joining us to talk about the sunny and rainy skies ahead is David Morris, a senior editor at Kiplinger. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We know that lots of things happen that we cannot predict. However, you have some real highlights in this report, positive things. So first, GDP and your forecast for the growth of the gross domestic product. What does that mean for folks' wallets in particular?
Well, their GDP will be as good as it's going to be this year. By year end, it could be as high as 3% on an annualized basis. That's a lot higher than it's been for a number of years. The reason it's going to be so high is because consumers are finally willing to take out their wallets and spend their money again. We're going to spend like it's 2004. That was a great time for consumers. We were close to full employment, or at least what we consider full employment. The economy was kicking along smoothly. The stock market was kicking along smoothly. And then we had the recession and nobody spent money. And this year, we're going to spend again, finally.
Considering the job growth and the job numbers, though, that is still a disappointing number. So are we spending because we're just feeling that pressure that we've been holding on to money for so long? Or is there actually going to be, and are we going to have, more money coming in terms of income?
Certainly the folks who don't have jobs, and there are still far too many, those folks aren't going to spend. They don't have anything to spend. But the people who are employed, they've held back for a long time. They're driving older cars than they used to drive. They're keeping the old clunky, noisy washer going instead of replacing it. And they're finally feeling that things are going good enough now. They've held their jobs through the recession. The worst is behind them. And they're ready to make some of those purchases that they've been putting off. But they're also ready to take trips, go on vacations, and spend money for things that aren't necessities, a little bit of luxury, if you will.
Talking about interest rates, this is one of those Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hydes for most people because, you know, we hear the complaining about, oh, my cash isn't making any money to keep up with inflation. But at the same time, we've been enjoying these amazingly historic lows in terms of interest rates on mortgages and such. You know, your prediction for interest rates is that they'll go up. So what kind of effect is that going to have both on either end, on the cash side and then on the housing market end?
They'll go up slightly. But, you know, there's quite a bit of room to go up without having too much of a negative effect. We've been, you know, at record low interest rates now for 3 years. So a little bit of an uptick won't really be noticed. You might complain a bit if you're a homeowner and you're just taking out a new mortgage. Your rate by the end of 2014 might be a percentage point higher than it is now. Maybe we're talking 5 to 5.5% by year end. Right now, you can still get into a 30-year loan for about 4.5. So that's a little bit more money out of pockets. It won't really affect spending. It won't be a damper on spending unless it goes higher than that. And we don't see that happening. The reason is the higher mortgage rates go, the fewer people look for homes, the fewer people buy homes. And the housing market is really one of the drivers of this, of the economic success that we've had. So as long as the rates don't totally throw a blanket over the housing market, it shouldn't really affect consumers too much.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen.
Those mortgages are a big financial deal, which brings us to our voicemail of the week from Sarah in Minnesota.
I am calling with a question. We have two little kids, a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. We live in the 850-square-foot house in St. Paul. We're hoping to get a little bit bigger house for the four of us. We're slightly underwater, and we have no equity to put into a new house. One idea is I have an old job. I'm 32. I have an old job with a 401k that I was thinking about taking a loan out of. So it's worth $60K. Thinking of taking a loan for $30K out of that 401k so we could pay the underwater fees and then a down payment on a new house. Is this a good or bad idea? The second portion of my question is I work for a retail company here in the Twin Cities that is having some security breach issues, and I'm a little bit worried about job security. So if I take a loan out of my 401k to get a little bit bigger house for our family of four and then lose my job, am I going to be in a lot of trouble? Should we suffer through the 850-square-foot house?
Oh, Sarah, I can hear the troops there with you with all that pressure and that small space. But here's the thing. It is very risky to take a loan out of that 401k because if you are to lose your job, you have to pay that loan back within 30 to 60 days. And what do you do then? Where would that money come from? If you couldn't get the money back, then you would lose almost half of it to fees and taxes because of the early withdrawal. Now, you mentioned that it's an old 401k. You probably couldn't borrow from that one at all. It has to be an active 401k with your current company. So here's the thing. What about a short sale? You mentioned making up the difference. A lot of lenders these days, for folks that are underwater, are willing to take a short sale, which means, of course, that you sell the house for less than the outstanding mortgage. Talk with your lender first. See what would need to be done to accept a short sale. Also, find a nonprofit credit counselor or housing counselor who can help you. Go to HUD.gov, Housing and Urban Development site, HUD.gov. Find a housing counselor there, as well as NFCC.org. That's National Federation Credit Counseling, and find another housing counselor there. I'm having you use all these resources so you can get a clear picture of what your chances are and get some guidance. And I'd hold off a bit, maybe on buying a new home. Make sure you're in good financial shape and you can get a really good interest rate. Good luck, Sarah. And know that there is a light at the end of this tunnel, and it's a lot bigger than 850 square feet.
Please leave a message after the tone.
So you want to ask me a question and get your answer on air? It's easy. Leave me a message. Make sure to say your name and where you're from so we can have you on. Visit MarketplaceMoney.org and select Record Audio right under Ask Carmen. Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, it's all credit all the time. How to get out of debt and how your credit score plays into your dating, your hiring, and oh yeah, those loans. It's an entire show on what you need to know. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Candice Manriquez, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Robbie Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember to always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.